Could you talk a little bit about how you approach that initial decision and what are the factors that you consider?
Well, first of all, we need to make sure that it truly is chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and this is where flow cytometry comes in. The key elements are to look at whether the patient has the expression of CD5 and CD19, CD20 and CD23 on their leukemic cells, and whether you can identify that it's a clonal disease on the basis of being predominantly a kappa light chain or a lambda light chain. So the major differential diagnoses that we have difficulty with end up being patients with mantle cell disease where the CD23 is negative, and a number of patients with marginal zone lymphoma or splenic lymphoma in a leukemic phase where oftentimes the CD5 is questionable, the CD23 is questionable. They usually have a bright intensity of CD20 and often have some FMC7 positivity, which is a different epitope of CD20. So that they then get a little bit confused. FMC7, is it pro-lymphocytic or is it not pro-lymphocytic? And I think in those circumstances, you have to put it in the clinical context. But if it's a straightforward CLL with the CD5, 19, 20, 23, you then sit down and say, okay, well, what's the stage of the disease? Because the stage is still important. The Rye classification, where if they just have a lymphocytosis, their Rye stage 0 has a very favorable prognosis. If they have nodes, it's Rye stage 1. If it's spleen, it's stage 2. Anemia, stage 3. And thrombocytopenia, stage 4. The next test that I pay most attention to is the serum beta 2 microglobulin, in that we have consistently found that there's a linear relationship with worsening prognosis as the beta 2 microglobulin goes higher. And even though this is a protein which is excreted in the kidneys, it has impact on prognosis way over and above what the creatinine clearance happens to be. And I think it's the best single prognostic factor that we have in play. We've done an algorithm whereby we look at the most important prognostic factors for survival, and age and beta 2 microglobulin are the two most important things that come in, and after that everything else becomes a lot less. So I think that it's very good to put those on the table, and you can get those within a very short period of time. The others that are brought to attention from the flow cytometry is the CD38 level. And the higher the CD38 level is, the more likely the patient is to have activated or active CLL. But I have personally not been as impressed with this as a lot of the literature. I note it and tell the patient about it because they'll often ask, but I don't make any decisions based on that at all. There's been a lot of splash about a tyrosine kinase called ZAP70. And this is, again, a measure of activation. It usually correlates fairly closely with the CD38 level. And the problem is that there is a lot of question as to what is the best technique to measure ZAP70 with flow cytometry. And even in our institution, we can't reproducibly get the right results. And if you check around with two or three different labs around the country, they will give you discordant results. So again, it's not a test that I place a lot of reliance on. The two most predictable tests, however, the mutation status of the immunoglobulin heavy chain sequence. And if the patients have more than 2% mutation, that's a very favorable parameter and suggests that the patients will not develop a greater evolution of the disease. If it's less than that, or so-called unmutated, they tend to have additional genetic changes that occur as the disease evolves. So that's one test that, even though it's not as readily available, I think it's one of the cornerstones of my thinking and planning because it remains consistent right through the course of the disease. So you can do it testing on patients that are relapsing and in any stage of the disease. The other thing is the cytogenetics. Now, when patients first come in, the CLL cells don't divide. So you can't do conventional cytogenetics on the majority of these patients, so you have to develop the fluorescent in situ hybridization or the FISH cytogenetics, which don't rely on dividing cells but have probes that will attach to particular sections of chromosomes. And the ones that are most readily measured are using the VISIS probe. This is VYSIS. And that will look at chromosomes 11, 12, 13, and 17. And if you have loss of chromosome 11Q, the long arm, this tends to be associated with bulky disease and more rapidly progressive disease. If you have an additional chromosome 12, it doesn't appear to mean very much, except the CD20 level is often higher in those patients than others, and the FMC7 may be positive. And then if you look at chromosome 13, that's often lost probably in about 60-70% of all patients with CLL will lose part of one or both chromosomes 13Q. And a small proportion of patients initially will lose part of chromosome 17 in the short arm or 17P. And this is associated with mutations and loss of function of the P53 gene, which is important in all the cancers that we look at. So they're the tests that take a couple of weeks to come back. So I usually will see a patient and do the history, physical exam, do the blood tests and beta 2 microglobulin, and that will be available the next day, and have the patients that I talk to and tell them what the results are from that point of view, and tell them that there will be additional information coming in the next couple of weeks. So have them come back for a consensus evaluation of prognosis at that time. I think in particular, we need to pay attention to the fact that most of the information we have is gathered from referral centers, and most of these patients less than 70 years of age, whereas most patients with CLL are diagnosed when they're above 70 years of age. So they're not totally representative, but they give us a decent guide.